Thank you for tuning in to the Israel Podcast, Episode 7. This is the third episode in a series on the Dreyfus Affair. In the last episode, we left off when Captain Alfred Dreyfus was convicted of high treason, degraded in a public military ceremony, and handed over to the French civilian prison system. This episode will mostly cover his exile on Devil's Island. All right, let's get into it. Alfred Dreyfus, no longer a captain, now inmate number 164, arrived at the Santé prison shortly after his degradation. He understood quite well the contempt felt by the soldiers lining the Cour Morland during the ceremony. He would later write, and I quote, "In their place, I too would have been unable to contain my scorn upon seeing an officer who had betrayed his country. But that is the tragedy. The traitor is not me." He was awaiting news of when and to where he would be deported. He was also probably struggling to reconcile the injustice of his conviction and the ideal of French justice he had never doubted. By now, Dreyfus was already exhibiting symptoms of what we call now chronic fatigue syndrome, and also psychological hardships of solitary confinement. Prison doctors, again, simply prescribed sedatives. Although his faith in French justice was still absolute, he was now questioning his physical ability to sustain the tortures that were still to come. He was absolutely certain that in time his innocence would be, as he wrote Lucy, "recognized and proclaimed by this beloved France, my fatherland, to whom I have always devoted my intelligence and my strength. When they return the golden officer's braids that I am as worthy to wear today as I was yesterday, and when I am finally leading our brave soldiers again, I will forget everything, the sufferings, the tortures, the outrageous insults. May God and human justice make that day come soon." Although the Ministry of the Interior had not yet announced his final destination, he knew that his first stop would be at the citadel of Saint-Martin-de-Ré on an island off the west coast of France. He would have a room and courtyard there, he told his niece, and conditions would be better. But he was wrong. Late that night, he was suddenly awakened by a deputy from the Interior Ministry. He was handcuffed, half-dressed, and without his glasses, dragged from his bed and hoisted into a horse-drawn carriage. The trip from the Santé prison to the train station lasted only a few minutes. He was then hurried off into a special train car with a row of small cages, each one barely large enough to accommodate a seated man. In leg irons and handcuffs, Alfred's limbs went numb. Without any food or drink, and shaking with fever, he waited all night for the train to depart. The next morning, after many appeals, the guards finally relented and gave him some coffee, bread, and cheese before the journey began. Traveling southwest from Paris, the prison train arrived at the port town of La Rochelle at noon. Transporting Dreyfus in secret, officials anticipated no incident at La Rochelle, but curious passers-by noted police activity near one train car and suspected that it carried special cargo. Rumors started spreading, and the numbers of onlookers increased. At one point, someone must have heard or overheard the prisoner's name. Cramped in his dark cell through the afternoon, Dreyfus listened to the crowd become more and more agitated. At night, deputies unlocked his leg irons, threw his coat over his shoulders, and tried to hurry him past the station's arrival gate. The mob pushed forward and tried to separate Dreyfus from his guards, shouting, "Into the water, death to the traitor, death to the Jew." Beaten with canes and with fists, spat upon and struck by a French officer using the butt of his saber, Dreyfus did not try to escape. He simply understood their anger. Finally pulled away from the crowds by two policemen, he was locked inside a waiting carriage. The wagon then headed toward the dock, and the crowd running behind it. Within minutes, Dreyfus embarked for the Ile de Ré. The night crossing from La Rochelle to the fortress at Saint-Martin-de-Ré took an hour. With his hands frostbitten, his wrists and ankles bruised from the iron restraints, and no eyeglasses, it was the last stop on his way to exile. In the prison, Dreyfus was to be stripped naked and searched every single day. And the letter-writing privileges he had known at Cherche Midi and Santé prisons were revised. He was now prohibited from contacting any member of his family except his wife. Conditions on the island were deplorable. His brother-in-law called them, and I quote, "absolutely barbarous, monstrous, and revolting." Convinced that an international Jewish syndicate would arrange his escape from the current penal colony of New Caledonia, a new law of exception, inspired by General Mercier and passed by the Chamber of Deputies on February 9th. The law declared that the Ile du Salut off of French Guiana had been reinstated as an official place of deportation in a fortified locale. The Islands of Salvation, once called the Devil's Islands, had been renamed by 18th century travelers seeking to escape the tropical diseases of the mainland. But despite the change, the islands, however, lived up to their former name. It was the next best thing to capital punishment. Under French law, deportees at least had the legal right to be joined by their spouses and children. Lucy tried to contact the colonial minister for authorization to sail with her husband on the same ship. But the French government was anxious to get rid of Alfred Dreyfus as soon as possible. The guard ordered him to pack his belongings into a single suitcase and a small duffel bag. He was stripped, searched, and led by six guards to a launch at the Citadel's dock. To avoid another demonstration, police had cordoned off the area to the public. The stone embankment was deserted. Dreyfus's launch traveled south to a small island near the port town of Rochefort, and in the middle of the night, he boarded a steamship. Ordered by the colonial minister never to speak to the prisoner, guards arranged the transfer in complete silence. Locked into a wire mesh cage just below the bridge, exposed to the wind, Dreyfus waited for the ship to sail. He was given no food, and the temperature plummeted to 7 degrees Celsius, or 44.6 Fahrenheit. 24 hours later, on February 22nd, the ship weighed anchor. Locked up in that small iron cage, with armed guards watching him day and night, Alfred still had no idea of his destination. Finally, on the fifth day, he was finally allowed on deck for 1 hour. Bitter cold soon gave way to warmer temperatures, and then to horrible heat. And by the eighth day, Dreyfus knew the ship approached the equator. The route to New Caledonia off the coast of Australia would have taken them in the other direction, south from La Rochelle through the Strait of Gibraltar and towards the Suez Canal. But they had steamed west. And at 1:30 p.m. on March 12th, after a voyage of 15 days, the ship dropped anchor in the harbor of the Ile Royale. Strategic studies of French territories, along with conversations he may have had on the ship, helped Dreyfus identify the three islands off of French Guiana in South America. 11 kilometers from the mainland and situated only 5 degrees north of the equator, the Ile Royale and its smaller neighbors were known for their desolation, disease, and unbearable heat. With the temperature reaching 40 degrees Celsius or 104 Fahrenheit on the day of Dreyfus's arrival, and without a breath of wind, the prisoner remained in his cage, exposed to the sun, while authorities prepared for his transfer. Unsteady from the long voyage, he had to be helped by a prison worker up the rough stone steps leading to the island's administration buildings. For 30 days, Dreyfus waited in a small guards room converted into a prison cell. On the second floor of that central building, it looked out on a yard where convicts sentenced to solitary confinement, barefoot, hands tied behind their backs, took their daily exercise. Dreyfus never joined them. Directives from Paris insisted on absolute secrecy, and authorities ordered that his shutters be kept closed and that he never be permitted outside. With his scissors and razor taken from his suitcase on arrival, his hair and beard grew longer. With inedible rations and oppressive tropical heat, he continued to lose weight. And like almost every other European who came to French Guiana, Alfred fell victim to intestinal parasites and to the fever that accompanied dysentery. On the day he arrived on the island, he wrote in his journal, "I will not recount my voyage. I was transported in a way befitting the vile scoundrel that I am taken to be. It is only just." Finally, at 2 p.m. on April 14th, he was taken out of his room for the first time in a month. Blinded by the light and weak from fever, he had to be helped down the path toward the shore. From the dock, Dreyfus watched the whale boat cross the rough waters between the Ile Royale and the Ile du Diable. Barely 1,000 meters long, slightly more than 1,000 yards, and only 200 meters or 220 yards at its narrowest point, it was a thin strip of land covered with dry brown bushes and volcanic rocks. With virtually no beachfront, its steepest cliff emerged directly from the sea at a height of 20 meters or some 60 feet. The island owed its name to the surrounding violent and shark-infested waters. Alfred and his escort disembarked on the Ile du Diable. On it was a small stone cabin with a corrugated iron roof, and nearby a small hut for 5 guards and their supervisor. And that's about it. Dreyfus would be the island's only inmate. Behind the prisoner's cabin, his guard pointed out wooden posts that marked the boundaries of an exercise area, fully exposed to the sun. Dreyfus was not allowed to walk there unaccompanied, and when war crews of convicts or provision boats from the Ile Royale approach, he would be taken back to his cell until the island was deserted. If any unidentified ships approached the islands, the guards would open fire. And if the prisoner attempted to escape, the order from the colonial minister was, and I quote, blow his brains out. Alfred's cabin was 4 square meters or 40 square feet, and with 2 small barred windows, an iron cot, a wooden table, 2 chairs, a washstand, and a large bucket. The water that Dreyfus used for washing, cooking, and drinking became a warm and stagnant reservoir of disease. There was no outhouse. A wooden waste tub was placed near his cot. The cell's grated padlocked door looked directly onto a small room where a guard was always on duty. At night, every 2 hours, an infernal noise of keys striking iron, as Dreyfus described it, jolted him awake and announced the change of a shift. It was impossible to sleep. Dreyfus was required to cook his own food, but he had, for a very long period, no plates, utensils, or iron grate for fire. Most often than not, the meat he was given was rotten and the coffee berries unroasted. Dreyfus had to throw most of his food into the sea and had to subsist on bread and water. He requested a drinking glass, but officials worried that he would use the shards to cut his throat or more likely attack a guard. After much delay, they sent along a couple of iron mugs instead. Under the strict orders never to talk to his guards, he could request provisions only in writing. On the evening of his first day, he started a journal destined for his wife, Lucy. Today, I begin the diary of my sad and tragic life. What has happened to the precious dreams of my childhood? To the hopes of my mature years? Nothing remains alive in me. Lucy, back in France, was still appealing the authorities to join her husband, only to hear one official say that life for a woman on the Île de Salut would be impossible. You have no idea what you would be exposing yourself to down there. Lucy understood that the climate would be too harsh for the children. She planned to leave them with the grandparents, but she insisted that she could survive anything. The new government under Prime Minister Alexandre Ribot broke French law concerning deportees and denied Lucy Dreyfus' request to join her husband. In the meantime, Mathieu began the battle against indifference and against the public's rush to forget. I understood my task, he later wrote, to undertake without tiring and without being discouraged by anything. Personal campaign of propaganda in every milieu I could penetrate, to make recruits and to ask them and all our friends to help find the criminal. But the case had become old news. There were a few officers in eastern France who dared to question the captain's guilt, but none would make a public stand. Dupaty's fervor, on the other hand, did not decline with Alfred's conviction. His henchmen opened Mathieu's mail, bribed his cook, housekeepers, and concierge, and followed him through the streets of Paris. Demange advised Mathieu to keep no important papers in his home, to watch his servants, and to avoid the crowded department stores of Paris, where an agent might slip an item into his pocket, arrest him for shoplifting, and ruin his reputation. The newly appointed President Faure, in office for barely a month, confessed in a meeting that Dreyfus had been convicted not on the basis of the bordereau, but based on documents given to the judges in the deliberation room, documents which neither the accused nor his lawyer could be shown for reasons of state. This gave Mathieu the hope that his brother's conviction could be reversed on a technicality, If he could not discover the traitor, he could at least expose the judiciator. Maître Demange, Dreyfus's lawyer, also learned about the secret documents through associates at the Palais de Justice. In particular, he described an item containing the phrase, "That scoundrel, D," which army intelligence had intercepted from a foreign power and inserted, without Demange's knowledge, into the trial dossier. But the summer of 1895, confirmed by one of France's leading lawyers and by the President of the Republic, Mathieu knew that his brother's court-martial in closed session had been a farce. Mathieu also knew that every passing hour was a century of suffering for his brother and another step towards death. Each time Lucy received an envelope from the colonial minister, she hesitated, knowing that it could contain news of her husband's death. Mathieu continuously searched for new avenues of appeal. Countless investigations by the family's private detectives achieved nothing. They were unable to move politicians or penetrate the general staff. And Mathieu found no way to reach his objective of highest interest, the German embassy, in which the bordereau had been originally found. Having witnessed firsthand the links between politics and police work in France, Mathieu decided to seek professional help across the channel. On April 15, 1896, Mathieu dodged undercover police and boarded a train bound for Dieppe in London. Through the Cook Detective Agency in England, he engaged the services of a young and skillful investigator, a perfect gentleman, who had been educated at Oxford and who spoke fluent German and French. The agent was tasked to infiltrate the Society of German Diplomats in Paris, as would another Cook employee, an intelligent and clever woman, whose aim it was to befriend the English wife of a German embassy guard suspected of contacts with the French government. In late summer 1896, Clifford Millage, Paris correspondent for the English newspaper The Daily Chronicle, agreed to help Cook mobilize support. He received substantial payments from Mathieu, but he also believed in the captain's innocence, and he knew of similar favorable sentiments among other English journalists. With economic and imperial rivalries and deep-seated contempt for the French, the English condemned the excesses of the French high command and the vitriol of the nationalist press. For many English observers, the Dreyfus scandal underscored the hypocrisy and simple bad form of their oldest enemy. In order to bring back attention to the case, they proposed spreading a rumor that Dreyfus had escaped. Some kind of sensational story was needed, Mathieu agreed, but he worried that the government, under pressure from the likes of Drummond, would respond by imposing even more painful punishment on his brother. He therefore insisted that the rumor be so improbable and absurd that after creating the desired effect, it would immediately be denied by the colonial minister. His English counterparts concurred. And on September 3rd, the Daily Chronicle announced that Captain Dreyfus had escaped from the Île du Salut aboard an American vessel. Neither the source of the story, a newspaper, nor the American ship ever existed. But that didn't stop the French press from immediately reprinting the article, stirring up emotions in Paris, as Leclerc reported. It described a sensational scenario that included Lucy Dreyfus, obviously well furnished with money, arranging the escape from her base in French Guiana. As expected, government officials denied the rumor and called it absolute fantasy. The family told reporters that Lucy is still in Paris, and although they are still very much committed to securing the captain's release, they would never support an escape attempt. The ploy had worked. Journalists and politicians were beginning to reconsider the case. But on September 4th, the colonial minister, André Lebon, cabled French Guiana and ordered Dreyfus contained to his cabin and locked into double shackles at night. Lebon knew very well that the Daily Chronicle story was false and that the prisoner could not possibly escape from an island secured by guards and surrounded by sharks. But Lebon was a young and ambitious cabinet member with a very blind commitment to Drummond's brand of anti-Semitism. For Alfred Dreyfus, Lebon would become one of the most sadistic players in a drama that had its share of diabolical characters. It took 2 days for workers on the Île de Royal to reconstruct a hospital bed equipped with an iron bar of justice, similar to an old wooden pillory. The guards would clamp the bar over Dreyfus's ankles at night. On September 6, adhering to the rule of silence and not responding to the prisoner's demands for explanation, the guards forced him into the iron buckle. Released from the shackles during the day, Alfred suffered temporary paralysis of his back, neck, and, although desperate for air, he was not allowed to leave his cabin. It would be 3 months before guards unbolted his door. And by that time, another order from Minister Lebon had been followed. A thick double fence, 2 meters or 7 feet high, surrounded his cabin, blocking the light and air from his window. It cut off his view from the sea. Back in France, the debate over the court-martial was reopened. Figaro and Casagnac Autorité hinted at irregularities that should be investigated. But the most important article, entitled The Traitor, appeared in Leclerc. Though hostile to Dreyfus and full of lies, it presented a detailed account of events from the day of the captain's arrest. And it exposed for the first time the existence of decisive secret documents communicated to judges in the deliberation room, out of the presence even of the accused. According to Leclerc, a letter from the German embassy in Paris to the Italian embassy, photographed by French agents in September 1894, contained the following sentence. "Decidedly, that animal Dreyfus is becoming too demanding." Well documented, serious in tone, and seemingly objective, the Leclerc article purported to provide irrefutable proof of the captain's treason. Demange drafted a petition to the Chamber of Deputies, signed by Lucy Dreyfus as the legal guardian of her husband's interest. It stated that, after debates cloaked in the most complete mystery, because of a closed session, a French officer has been condemned on the basis of an accusation which neither the accused nor his counsel could discuss. This is a negation of all justice. The public conscience should have been aroused by revelations of a miscarriage of justice, Mathieu had thought. The appeal should have provoked universal condemnation. But there was absolutely nothing. On the second anniversary of his brother's arrest, Mathieu began to move towards a more public campaign. Like the prisoner on Devil's Island, he never questioned the integrity of the nation's institutions. Family had faith in the institutions of their fatherland, simply because, across the decades, French law, if not always French legislators, had respected the covenant of emancipation. For the family members, the captain's arrest was a tragic error committed by individuals who were either criminal or misguided, but it had nothing to do with the failures of French justice. This was also the tone set by a letter received from Alfred himself. And I quote, "Above all, and no matter what the cost, the interests of the country must be respected. Search for the truth with energy and decisiveness, but always for France and with France." During a series of meetings through late February and March, Mathieu told Bernard Lazare, a young poet and journalist, about the bordereau, the disagreement among graphologists, and the inquisitorial methods of the prosecution. He asked the writer to compose a memoir exposing the judicial error. Written in a clear, vigorous style, Lazare summarized the facts and exposed with precision the lesser-known fantasies, conspiracies, and lies perpetrated by the accusers and so-called handwriting experts. In the autumn of 1896, when the Daily Chronicle and Leclerc articles returned his brother's case to the public arena, Mathieu arranged for Lazare to travel to Brussels, where the pamphlet would be printed to avoid legal action. In early November, 3,000 French notables, judges, journalists, deputies, and senators received copies titled "A Judicial Error: The Truth About the Dreyfus Affair." Lazare's pamphlet kept the story alive. Joseph Reinach, member of the Chamber of Deputies, friend of Maître Demange, and an early advocate for the captain that he did not know, met Bernard Lazare shortly before the pamphlet's publication. He detested the writer's anarchism, but had been impressed by his battle against anti-Semitism. "We are each of us being attacked as Jews," Lazare told Reinach. "This is why we can forget our economic and philosophical differences and agree on the fight to be waged against anti-Semitism." Reinach would bring political wisdom to the Dreyfus campaign. On November 10th, on the heels of Lazare's brochure, the Parisian daily Le Matin published a facsimile of the bordereau, the incriminating document that had never been seen in public. One of the handwriting experts had kept a photograph of the memorandum, and when the trial became front page news 2 years later, he sold the item to Le Matin. Acting to quickly capitalize on the considerable publicity unleashed by the bordereau's appearance, Mathieu paid for posters that displayed examples of the captain's handwriting alongside the copy of the memorandum. By the early spring of 1897, graphologists hired by Mathieu had confirmed the differences between the prisoner's handwriting and that on the bordereau. Mathieu, so certain that this would be the key to his brother's release, engaged an additional half-dozen graphologists from Switzerland, Belgium, England, and the United States. Every expert reaffirmed that the bordereau could not have been the work of Alfred Dreyfus. For months, Reinach had been trying to enlist the support of Auguste Scherer-Kastner, the highly respected vice president of the Senate, an Alsatian Protestant from Mulhouse. The senator had early doubts that an officer from Mulhouse of considerable wealth and good reputation could betray his fatherland. The senator confided in Reinach that he had been given proof of Dreyfus's innocence, that for the moment must remain confidential. He insisted that the captain's fate was linked to the fate of the Republic. "I tell you that Dreyfus is innocent," he wrote. "I tell you that we know it. I tell you that such things are unacceptable in the 19th century. They dishonor the Republic." Without divulging the information that he had promised to keep confidential, Scherer-Kastner tried to encourage the family's investigation. "Look in the military directory for an infantry commandant with two names and from an aristocratic background," he instructed Mathieu. I cannot tell you more. I am bound by my word. But search thoroughly, and you will find a name. But aristocrats with hyphenated names dominated the military directories of the time. Sure, Costner's clues were just too vague. But he would also not comment any further. He promised to keep his source confidential and would do nothing to embarrass the Republic or divide the nation. In the late fall of 1897, an unknown Parisian stockbroker was waiting for a horse-drawn carriage on the Place de la Madeleine. His name was De Castro, and glancing at a poster he had just purchased from a vendor, he recognized the handwriting on the bordereau. Returning to his office, he searched through papers of former clients and found letters written in a hand identical to that on the memorandum. In November 1897, 3 years after Alfred's arrest and his own arrival in Paris, Mathieu met De Castro at a private businessman's club on the Boulevard Montmartre. And he finally learned the traitor's name. With the letters of De Castro's former client spread on a table next to the poster, Mathieu was immediately struck by the extraordinary resemblance of the handwriting. Having spent many hours with a magnifying glass in hand, he had already become an amateur graphologist. Cross-checking the letters and the memorandum, slowly and with care, he identified every peculiarity and knew that he had found the criminal. On the back of one of the letters, he read the signature of the man responsible for his brother's dishonor, a name he had never seen before. Commandant Mario Charles Ferdinand Walzan Esterhazy, a French officer of Hungarian descent. He had been one of the stockbroker's most detestable clients, always short of money, and with a notorious reputation as a gambler, womanizer, crook, and swindler. Mathieu rushed from the club directly to the senator's Paris quarters and tried to convince him to break his silence. But the senator, honor-bound, would not divulge what he knew. "Then I will tell you the traitor's name," Mathieu declared. "It's Esterhazy." "Sure," Costner, feeling a weight lifted from his shoulders, replied, "Yes, it is him." Back on Devil's Island, however, Dreyfus was keeping to a routine he set back in 1895. To save himself from the debilitating heat of the midday sun, he woke early, at 5:15 in the morning, and then, when provisions were available and edible, he prepared a small plate of vegetables and a tin mug of coffee or tea. He then made up his cot, washed, and received daily rations at 8 a.m. Prohibited from possessing a razor, a knife, or scissors, he never shaved, and his hair and beard, rapidly turning gray, would be cut only infrequently by an inmate sent from the Ile Royale. After lunch, which he had at 10 in the morning, Dreyfus remained under the cover of his sweltering but shaded stone hut, sweeping the floor, mending his clothes, reading and writing letters. Constantly sweating through his prison garb, he washed again, and in the late afternoon, with an armed guard always at his side, he worked outside fetching water or cutting wood for his cooking stove. By the summer of 1895, he began receiving, on an irregular basis, boxes his wife filled with items from Paris shops and delivered to the colonial office, containing condensed milk, coffee, cigarettes, pipe tobacco, chocolate, and biscuits. The packages were searched and often, it seems, pilfered by local officials. Dreyfus smoked constantly to calm his nerves. When tobacco ran out, he filled his pipe with dried tea leaves. He called a period after 6 p.m. when sentries locked him in his case, the longest moment of the day. Nightmares were constant and violent. He would jolt himself awake with a scream. At first, guards used to rush into his cell, but the nightmares became as routine as the rancid food and dysentery. Alfred was simply left alone to shout himself into exhaustion or cry himself to sleep. He also recorded with precision his temperature, pulse rate, doses of medicine, campaigns against insects. He watched his cabin thermometer rise degree by degree, hour by hour, and when strong enough to put pen to paper, he charted it all. Dreyfus's strong constitution helped him survive the many diseases of Devil's Island. His guards were often overcome by illness and forced to leave the island. Still alone, never speaking to a single person, never hearing a human voice, he noted in his journal in June 1895, and many, many times afterwards. By his second year in exile, his voice had become so hoarse from lack of use, and on those rare occasions when officials demanded a response, he found it difficult to translate his thoughts into coherent sounds. According to medical reports, he spoke only with great effort. He forced himself to stay awake during the hot midday hours, customary time for siesta in French Guiana, in the hope that he could get some sleep at night. He occupied this time with chores, English lessons using the exam books Lucy had sent from Paris, and letter writing, often tearing up 10 drafts for every one he sent. Remembering his university courses in solid geometry and in integral and differential calculus, he reconstructed complex problems and moved with sophisticated skill to the logical end. When his health permitted, he walked the periphery of the field behind his hut and later the small yard marked off by the high wooden fence. These walks, however, drew protests from guards who refused to tolerate the heat. When the commandant ordered Dreyfus to slow down or face the consequences, the prisoner again turned to his journal and wrote, "I am pursued everywhere, and everything I do is wrong. When I walk too quickly, they say I exhaust the guards who must follow me. When I announce that I will no longer leave my hut, they say they will punish me." In addition to the dozen Shakespeare plays he read and reread on Devil's Island, he also spent long hours with Voltaire and Rousseau, Balzac and Hugo, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, Nietzsche and Ibsen. He read the memoirs of Napoleon and studied the scientific and literary periodicals of the time. From Descartes and Kant to Pasteur and Claude Bernard, it was, for the most part, a repertoire of the modern age of science and reason, a hand-picked gallery of rationalists whose beliefs fitted well with Dreyfus's own. But above all else, he enjoyed Shakespeare. "Money is nothing, honor is all," he had insisted, but Shakespeare put it better. In one letter, Dreyfus reminded Lucy of those lines from the third act of Othello. "Who steals my purse, steals trash. 'Tis something, nothing. 'Twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him, and makes me poor indeed." Dreyfus told his wife, "Yes, The wretch who stole my honor has made me poor indeed. Shakespeare provided a fresh vocabulary and introduced into the silence and solitude of Devil's Island other intrigues, other stories of foul play, which helped Dreyfus feel less alone. Since the days in Sante prison, his first classroom of one, Dreyfus had been studying English to break the terrible monotony of waiting, and in the hope that he could better grasp the essence of Shakespeare's plays. Functionaries who examined the prisoner's every word considered those exercises insignificant. But when rumors spread in Paris that his dictionaries and primers might be code books linking him to foreign co-conspirators, officials order a full-scale surprise ransacking of all his possessions. Late at night, with guns drawn, guards stormed into his cabin, cut through his mattress, searched through his laundry, tore off the heels to his shoes, and ordered him to strip. Reports filed later described Dreyfus laughing at the absurdity of it all. And when guards found no code book on his person or on his shelf, they allowed him to keep his insignificant English books. Returning to his studies, he copied English exercises for 3 and even 4 hours a day. Alfred had a gift for languages. He was fluent in German, proficient in Italian and Latin, and by the third year in exile, he was reading Othello in English. Back in Sante prison, while awaiting his deportation, Alfred had asked Lucy to send a picture he would place between those of Pierre and Jean. "Your 3 images before my eyes will be the companions of my sad solitude." Lucy admitted that she was embarrassed to pose for a photographer, but she agreed to do anything that would give her husband a few minutes of contentment. It gave him much more than that. And as he sat at his small table before the wood-framed portraits of his wife and children, he recorded in his journal, "I must live for them." Minister Le Bon increased the number of guards from 5 to 10 and then to 13, and in the summer of 1897, ordered the construction of an even more secure prison complex on the highest slope of the island. When a prison official visited his cabin in the fall of 1898, Dreyfus announced that he had decided to be finished with life. "I have had enough." The official told him to think of his wife and his children. 3 weeks later, at 12:30 p.m. on November 16, 1898, Alfred Dreyfus received a telegram from the governor of French Guiana. On behalf of the colonial minister, the governor announced, "The criminal branch of the Supreme Court of Appeal has declared acceptable in form the application for a revision of your judgment and has ordered that you be notified of this decision and be invited to set forth your defense." After 48 months in prison, of which 43 months in exile on Devil's Island, Dreyfus would soon be making his way back to France. With the news of his pending liberation, guards opened the gates of his wooden fence and allowed him to walk along a path marked off by a low stone wall. For the first time in 2 years, he saw the ocean. Gathering up rough brown volcanic stones, he built a sturdy bench, a chair of rock, that later prisoners on Devil's Island would call Dreyfus's bench And then he sat in silence, looking out to the horizon. In December 1898, Dreyfus received further confirmation that his case had been reopened. And he read the public prosecutor's summary of events with profound astonishment. For the first time, he learned of his brother's accusations against the commandant Esterhazy, and he tried to make sense of the prosecutor's allusions to forgeries, confessions, and officers' suicide, and other incidents he could not comprehend. He hoped that additional reports would clarify his questions, but none arrived. After nearly 5 years of solitary confinement on a small rock in the ocean, Dreyfus had learned much about the human capacity for evil. He had learned it from Dupaty and André Le Bon in Paris. But he had also learned it from Commandant Daniel and many of his guards on Devil's Island. But he had survived. And he owed that survival to his family, who had never wavered. He had been telling Lucy from the first day, above all human passions, above all human error, there is the fatherland, and it will be my supreme judge. In his last letter from Devil's Island, he confirmed that his faith had not diminished. He still expressed profound respect for the army to which he had devoted his life. My confidence in the justice of my country is the same. It will be the honor of this noble France, the honor of our dear army, to finally arrive at a solution to this horrific judicial error and to its reparation. 4 days later, the chief guard entered his cabin and handed him a document. The court rescinds and annuls the judgment proclaimed on the 22nd of December 1894 against Alfred Dreyfus and remands the accused to a court-martial. As a result of this decision, Captain Dreyfus ceases to be subjected to the regime of deportation and becomes a simple prisoner. He is restored to his rank and allowed to again wear his uniform. The report ended with news that the cruiser Sfax leaves today with orders to take the prisoner from Devil's Island and bring him back to France. At 7 a.m. on the morning of June 9, 1899, Dreyfus began the first leg of the Atlantic crossing. He arrived on Devil's Island as a condamné, a convict. He would depart as a prévenu, prisoner, still officially accused of a crime, but confident that exoneration awaited him on the French mainland. By late morning, the prisoner had been installed in a special cabin with a barred porthole and an armed guard. A few hours later, Devil's Island disappeared behind the bluish mist of the Guiana Sea coast. 12 days later, Dreyfus saw the coastline of France. I returned in search of justice. The horrible nightmare had come to an end. Captain Alfred Dreyfus was certain that he would soon be promoted and return to a military command in France. But the silence that reigned on Devil's Island continued aboard the Sfax, and officials never told the prisoner the details of his landing. On the night of June 30th, in the midst of a torrential rainstorm, he was ordered to jump from the cruiser's side ladder into a small dinghy. He injured both legs, and as the boat headed towards the coast, he was seized by fever and chills. Finally, at 2:15 in the morning of July 1st, he set foot on French soil. There was no festive homecoming. He arrived on a dark, deserted beach, lined with policemen and mounted troops. He was hurried into an open carriage and then taken to a special train. He traveled in the company of 13 policemen and 4 detectives, all silent. Only at dawn, as the procession galloped through the streets of a large provincial city and towards a military prison, Dreyfus learned that he had disembarked on the southern coast of Brittany and that he had been taken to Reims, the place he was certain his innocence would be proclaimed and his nightmare would end. A letter was waiting for him in prison. "I want you to receive word from me when you arrive," Lucy had written. "And I want you to know that I'm close by, in the same city, with my heart beating with joy and emotion." The Dreyfuses had rented the house of a widow for the duration of the captain's retrial. Shaded by trees and surrounded by a high wall with an iron gate, the house was on the same narrow street as the military prison. On the morning of his arrest, nearly 5 years before, he must have been at the peak of his physical health. He had both strength and stamina. But now, although he was only 39, his thinning hair had gone almost completely white. Since his early bouts with malaria, he suffered sudden flushes of fever that turned his face bright red and exaggerated his prominent cheekbones. His voice was strangled and almost inaudible. Years of silence damaged his vocal cords, and years of malnutrition and disease had inflamed his gums and rotted his teeth. He could utter only raspy hissing sounds. Less than 3 hours after arriving in Reims, Dreyfus learned that his wife would meet him in a few minutes in an adjoining room. Suddenly and uncontrollably, he collapsed and cried. In pain from the injuries sustained a few hours before, and being physically and mentally beyond exhaustion, he was unprepared for the reunion he had dreamed about every day and every night in exile. I think we'll stop here for now. Again, most of the research is from a great book by Michael Burns, Dreyfus, A Family Affair. I will leave a link in the show notes, or you can simply visit theisraelpodcast.com/episode007. In the next episode, we'll dive into Dreyfus's second trial and what I consider the core of the affair. The chamber pot is about to hit the fan. Thanks for listening, checking out the Israel Podcast. I hope you tune in next time for another episode.